This is the October 2020 civil procedure update based on New York State appellate decisions dealing with civil procedure released in the month of October 2020. The summaries of those decisions were posted on the New York Appellate Digest website, and they've been collected in the October 2020 civil procedure update pamphlet, and the references to the pages are to the pages in that pamphlet. The first case we're going to discuss is Van Epps on page 7. It deals with an appellate issue. Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court's dismissal of the complaint in this traffic accident case, noted that the plaintiff's failure to address an aspect of the decision granting defendant's motion for summary judgment constituted an abandonment of any challenge to that portion of the decision. The motion court had dismissed the complaint in its entirety, including plaintiff's cause of action alleging defendants were negligent in not providing seat belts for the limousine in which plaintiff was a passenger. However, the seat belt ruling was not challenged by the plaintiffs on appeal. Therefore, Supreme Court's dismissal of the seat belt cause of action remained in effect even as the rest of the complaint was reinstated. The court wrote, "The court granted that part of defendant's motion seeking to dismiss plaintiff's claim that defendants were negligent in failing to provide seat belts on the ground that defendants were under no duty to do so. Plaintiffs failed to brief any argument with respect to the dismissal of that claim, thereby abandoning any challenge to that part of the order. We modify the order by reinstating the complaint, except insofar as the complaint alleges that defendants were negligent in failing to provide seat belts." So the takeaway here is the plaintiffs didn't include in their appeal any mention of one of their causes of action in the complaint, that being the cause of action based on the failure to provide seat belts. And because that cause of action had been dismissed by the motion court and no mention of it was made on appeal, the appellate court did not reinstate it. Next case is Workers' Compensation Board of New York. It's on pages 9 and 10. It deals with a jurisdictional issue which is unique to the workers' compensation law. The Third Department held a judgment entered in Supreme Court by the county clerk pursuant to Workers' Compensation Law Section 26 is not reviewable by the Supreme Court. The Workers' Compensation Board assessed a penalty against defendant for failure to maintain workers' compensation coverage. When a penalty was not paid, the judgment was entered by the county clerk as a ministerial act which cannot be addressed by a motion in Supreme Court to vacate the judgment. The court wrote, "Defendants ignore the peculiar statutory scheme by which only this court, meaning the appellate court, may review a final determination by plaintiff with respect to assessments ordered pursuant to Workers' Compensation Law, Section 52, Subdivision 5. Workers' Compensation Law, Section 26, provides that where an employer fails to pay an assessment imposed pursuant to Workers' Compensation Law, Section 52, within 20 days after its due, plaintiff's chair may file a certified copy of the order imposing such assessment with the county clerk where the employer's principal place of business is maintained. Thereupon, judgment must be entered in the Supreme Court by the clerk of such county in conformity therewith immediately upon such filing. Such judgment shall be entered in the same manner, have the same effect, and be subject to the same proceedings as though rendered in a suit duly heard and determined by the Supreme Court, except that no appeal may be taken therefrom." That's Workers' Compensation Law, Section 26. "The entry of such judgment is merely a ministerial act made pursuant to Workers' Compensation Law, Section 26. Supreme Court lacked the authority to vacate the judgment because the underlying order was not issued by that court." So the takeaway here in the context of workers' compensation, a workers' compensation statute provides that an order by the Workers' Compensation Board, which is filed by the county clerk, is a ministerial act and cannot be contested in Supreme Court. Only the appellate division can review the board's imposition of an assessment against the employer for failure to maintain workers' compensation coverage. Next is King versus Klocek, K-L-O-C-E-K, pages 10 and 11. It's a lawsuit against a retailer for selling ammunition to someone who was under 21, and that person shot plaintiff's decedent. So the civil procedure issue is whether this products liability action against the retailer for selling ammunition was prohibited by a federal statute called Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act, PLCAA. It's 15 U.S.C. 7901. And the court determined, this was the Fourth Department, that the products liability action against the retailer was not prohibited by that Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act. The Fourth Department held the complaint alleging defendant retailer negligently sold ammunition to a 20-year-old named Klocek, who shot plaintiff's decedent, properly survived a motion to dismiss. The action was not precluded by the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act. The court wrote, a qualified civil liability action prohibited by the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act does not include an action brought against the seller for negligent entrustment or negligence per se, or an action in which a manufacturer or seller of a qualified product knowingly violated a state or federal statute applicable to the sale or marketing of the product, and the violation was a proximate cause of the harm for which relief is sought. So that federal statute did not prohibit this products liability case against the retailer. Next is the HSBC Bank case on pages 11 and 12. It deals with a dismissal for failure to prosecute pursuant to CPLR 3216. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the action should not have been dismissed pursuant to CPLR 3216 because the 90-day notice was defective. The court wrote, the certification order, which purported to serve as a 90-day notice pursuant to CPLR 3216, was defective as it did not state that the plaintiff's failure to comply with the demand would serve as a basis for the Supreme Court on its own motion to dismiss the action for failure to prosecute. The action was ministerially dismissed without a motion or notice to the parties, and there was no order of the court dismissing the action. So the takeaway here, this is a recurring issue. When an order purporting to serve as a 90-day notice requiring the filing of a note of issue doesn't meet the strict criteria of CPLR 3216, in this case, the order does not explicitly state that noncompliance allows Supreme Court on its own motion to dismiss the action for failure to prosecute. The failure to include that in the notice renders it defective, and any ministerial act, the dismissal here, is without effect. Next is Peisker versus Price Leasing Corporation on page 12. It's a choice of forum case. Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the plaintiff's choice of forum should have been upheld. The court wrote, plaintiff was injured in a motor vehicle accident while driving a truck owned by defendant. Plaintiffs are residents of New York, and defendant has an office and transacts business in New York, but the accident occurred in Virginia. Plaintiffs thereafter commenced this negligence action in New York. Supreme Court subsequently granted defendant's motion to dismiss the complaint on forum nonconvenience grounds, reasoning that defendant would be prejudiced by litigating this action in New York because it would be unable to subpoena either the Virginia State Police officers who investigated the accident or the medical providers who treated plaintiff in Virginia immediately following the accident. Where a plaintiff is a New York resident, a defendant bears the heavy burden of establishing that New York is an inappropriate forum before plaintiff's choice of forum will be disturbed. Defendant failed to meet that heavy burden here. Although New York courts lack the authority to subpoena out-of-state non-party witnesses, defendants submitted no evidence establishing that the investigating police officers and the emergency medical providers would not testify voluntarily in New York. The court's speculation to the contrary is unsupported by the record. In any event, both New York and Virginia are parties to the Uniform Interstate Depositions and Discovery Act, that's CPLR 3119, and defendant could, if necessary, depose the witnesses in Virginia and introduce those depositions at trial in lieu of in-person testimony in New York. So the takeaway here, it wasn't enough for the defendant to argue the case should not be heard in New York because the accident happened in Virginia and out-of-state non-party witnesses, police officers, and emergency personnel could not be subpoenaed by a New York court. The defendant didn't demonstrate, first of all, that the witnesses would not appear voluntarily, and in addition, the witnesses can be deposed in Virginia pursuant to the Uniform Interstate Depositions and Discovery Act. Next is funding metrics on page 14, just a brief mention of it. It deals with a motion to vacate a confession of judgment. Ordinarily, a judgment entered upon the filing of an affidavit of confession of judgment can't be vacated by bringing a motion. A plenary action is usually required. The exception to that rule is where, as in this case, the funding metrics case, it was argued that the court where the judgment of, was entered didn't have subject matter jurisdiction. And that argument didn't work, but it was a proper argument to make in Supreme Court by way of a motion to vacate instead of bringing a plenary action. Next is Sherman versus Sherman. It deals with what controls when there's a discrepancy between a separation agreement, this is a family court case, and the judgment. The Third Department, reversing family court, held the provisions in the judgment of divorce, not the separation agreement, controlled father's child support obligations. The court wrote, although the parties entered into a separation agreement directing what the husband was to pay for child support, the subsequent judgment of divorce specifically provided that the child support obligations of the parties shall be directed by the corrective order of support entered on November 16, 2017. A conflict, therefore, exists between the separation agreement and the subsequently entered judgment of divorce. In such circumstance, the judgment of divorce controls. Next is Matter of Allison, R.R., on page 17. It's another family law case. It deals with the jurisdiction of family court. Here, a same-sex couple asked the court to declare the parentage of a child born to that couple. The Third Department, in a full opinion by Justice Devine, held family court did not have subject matter jurisdiction over the petition to declare petitioners a same-sex married couple as the legal parents of the child conceived with donated sperm. Although the Family Court Act allows the court to determine paternity for a female parent, the court's jurisdiction in that regard is limited to children born out of wedlock, so the statute is out of date. The Third Department noted that legislation will soon allow a family court petition for a judgment of parentage, and Supreme Court has jurisdiction to hear an application for a declaratory judgment on that issue. The court wrote, the legislature has only empowered family court to hear proceedings to determine parentage and for the support of children born out of wedlock, and further defined a child in Family Court Act Article 5 as one born out of wedlock. Petitioners were married at all relevant times, and their child was not born out of wedlock. We note the recent enactment of Family Court Act Article 5-C, which will soon allow a petition for a judgment of parentage. If petitioners articulate how an adjudication of the merits will result in immediate and practical consequences to them, they are presently free to bring a declaratory judgment action in Supreme Court to determine the status of the child and the rights of all interested parties. So the takeaway here, because the controlling statute remains outdated, family court didn't have jurisdiction to declare the same-sex married petitioners to be the parents of a child born during the marriage. The outdated parentage statute refers only to children born out of wedlock. That family court restriction is soon to be eliminated, and petitioners can now seek a declaration of parentage in Supreme Court. Next is Buddha T. On page 18, it simply stands for the proposition that there is no civil cause of action, common law cause of action, for sexual harassment. The court wrote, New York does not recognize an independent common law cause of action to recover damages for sexual harassment. Rather, allegations of sexual harassment, which typically arise in the context of an asserted violation of Title VII of the Civil Rights Law or the New York City Human Rights Law, may form the basis of cognizable common law tort theories such as assault and battery, negligent training and supervision, and intentional infliction of emotional distress, but there's no separate common law action for sexual harassment in New York State. Next is Townsend versus New York City Housing Authority, pages 18 and 19. It deals with the question whether res ipsa loquitur is a cause of action that needs to be included in the notice of claim and in the pleadings. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff properly raised res ipsa loquitur in opposition to defendant's motion for summary judgment, even though the notice of claim and the complaint did not allege it. Res ipsa loquitur is not a theory of liability. It is a rule of evidence. The court wrote, plaintiff investigated a hissing sound coming from the electrical circuit box in her apartment, and as she drew close to the circuit box, it suddenly burst into flames, burning her right arm. Plaintiff may raise res ipsa loquitur in opposition to defendant's motion without having alleged the doctrine in her notice of claim or complaint, as it is not a separate theory of liability, but rather an evidentiary rule that involves a common sense application of the probative value of circumstantial evidence. To the extent defendant argues its lack of notice of the alleged dangerous condition, a triable issue of fact exists here regarding the applicability of the res ipsa doctrine, and proof of notice of a dangerous condition may be inferred under that doctrine. So the takeaway here, res ipsa loquitur is an evidentiary doctrine which can be raised in the litigation even if not mentioned in the pleading or the notice of claim, and the doctrine also serves to create a question of fact about whether the defendant had constructive notice of the dangerous condition. Next is Matter of Manufacturers and Traders Trust Company. It's on pages 19 and 20. It deals with the appealability of an order after a motion to reargue. Third Department noted that where the court addresses the merits of a motion to reargue, it will be deemed to have granted the motion to reargue for purposes of appeal. Therefore, although the denial of a motion to reargue is not appealable, the denial after addressing the merits is appealable. In that case, the motion is treated as if the motion to reargue were granted and then the original decision was adhered to. Next is Matter of Daimler Trust on pages 20 and 21. The main purpose it is here is to demonstrate that evidence submitted in a surreply should not have been considered by the court. Third Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the petition brought by the owner of a leased vehicle damaged in an accident, seeking a declaration that the respondent repair shop's garage keeper's lien was null and void because it did not authorize the repair, should not have been granted. Evidence submitted by the petitioner in surreply should not have been considered. Therefore, the petition should not have been granted on the merits, and the respondent repair shop should have been allowed to submit an answer. So the takeaway here, where the opposing party does not have the opportunity to respond, in this case to respond to evidence submitted in surreply, a court should not consider the new evidence. Next is O'Neill versus Environmental Products Corporation on pages 21 and 22. It's another case dealing with what can be considered in reply papers. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the late summary judgment motion and an excuse offered in reply papers should not have been considered. The court wrote, pursuant to CPLR 3212, courts have considerable discretion to fix a deadline for filing summary judgment motions so long as the deadline is not earlier than 30 days after filing the note of issue, or unless set by the court, later than 120 days after the filing of the note of issue, except with leave of court on good cause shown. As a general matter, a court should not consider a good cause argument proffered by a movant if it is presented for the first time in reply papers. Here, it is undisputed that the defendant moved for summary judgment approximately 30 days after the date set by the Supreme Court without seeking leave of the court or offering an explanation showing good cause for the delay in their moving papers. As a result, the court improvidently exercised its discretion in considering that branch of defendant's motion, which was for summary judgment dismissing the complaint, insofar as asserted against it and in considering the good cause arguments raised for the first time in defendant's reply papers. So the takeaway, if you're making a late motion for summary judgment, demonstrate good cause for the late motion in your initial moving papers. Don't wait and try to demonstrate good cause in your reply papers. Even if the motion court considers the reply papers, you risk reversal on appeal. Next is U.S. Bank versus Vieira, page 23. Deals with the an extension of time to serve the complaint. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff's motion pursuant to CPLR 306-B to extend the time to serve the defendant should have been granted, and the court explained the criteria. The court wrote, CPLR 306-B provides in pertinent part that service of the summons and complaint shall be made within 120 days after the commencement of the action. If service is not made upon a defendant within the time provided in this section, the court, upon motion, shall dismiss the action without prejudice as to that defendant, or upon good cause shown, or, in the interest of justice, extend the time for service. The interest of justice standard requires a careful judicial analysis of the factual setting of the case and a balancing of the competing interests presented by the parties. Unlike an extension requested premised on good cause, a plaintiff need not establish reasonably diligent efforts at service as a threshold matter. However, the court may consider diligence or lack thereof along with any other relevant factor in making its determination, including expiration of the statute of limitations, the meritorious nature of the cause of action, the length of delay in service, the promptness of plaintiff's request for an extension of time, and prejudice to the defendant. The Supreme Court improvidently exercised its discretion in denying the plaintiff's motion pursuant to CPLR 306-B for an extension of time to serve the defendant in the interest of justice, considering the expiration of the statute of limitations, the meritorious nature of the plaintiff's cause of action, the plaintiff's prompt request for an extension, and the lack of prejudice to the defendant. So the takeaway here, an extension of time to serve the summons and complaint can be granted pursuant to CPLR 306-B for good cause or in the interest of justice, two different sets of criteria. Here the factors warranting an interest of justice extension included the expiration of the statute of limitations, the meritorious nature of the causes of action, the prompt request for an extension, and the lack of prejudice to the defendant. Next is U.S. Bank on page 24. It's another case dealing with an extension of time to serve. The Third Department, reversing Supreme Court, held Plaintiff Bank's motion to extend the time for service of the complaint in the interest of justice should have been granted. The Third Department noted that defendant had waived the statute of limitations defense by not asserting it in an answer or a motion to dismiss, and Supreme Court should not have canceled the mortgage because defendant didn't request that relief. The court wrote, plaintiff may be granted an extension of time to serve process upon a defendant upon good cause shown or in the interest of justice. Even if we agreed with defendant that plaintiff failed to satisfy the good cause standard of CPLR 306-B, we find that plaintiff established its entitlement to an extension of time in the interest of justice. The record discloses that approximately 1 month after commencing this action, plaintiff made numerous attempts to serve defendant at the address provided on the mortgage documents. Plaintiff likewise cross-moved for an extension of time to cure any service defects approximately 1 month after defendant raised the issue of improper service. Defendant does not argue that she would suffer any prejudice if an extension of time was granted, taking into account that plaintiff's demonstrated the merits of its claim. Plaintiff's cross-motion, to the extent that it sought an extension of time to serve process in the interest of justice, should have been granted. So the takeaway here, even if pursuant to CPLR 306-B, the good cause standard for an extension of time to serve the summons and complaint is not met, the interest of justice standard may apply. Here the extension was warranted in the interest of justice. Plaintiff made several attempts to serve defendant about 1 month after the action was commenced and made a motion to extend the time about 1 month after defendant alleged improper service. And the defendant didn't allege any prejudice, and plaintiff demonstrated the merits of the action. Next is matter of Town of Waterford on pages 25 and 26. It's an environmental law case dealing with the issue of standing to bring the action. Although the Third Department held the Department of Environmental Conservation, that's the DEC, had properly conducted its State Environmental Quality Review Act review of the proposed modification of a landfill, the petition by nearby residents should not have been denied on the ground that the petitioners did not have standing to contest the DEC ruling. The court wrote, "At least some of the petitioners will suffer distinct environmental harm under the circumstances presented in these proceedings. For instance, although one might expect the visual impact of the landfill expansion to be widespread, DEC specifically found that the impact would be limited and that the areas where the individual petitioners live or maintain recreation facilities would be among the few having a generally unobstructed view of the landfill. Many of the individual petitioners confirmed that they can see the landfill from their residences, explained how they are personally impacted by the sights, sounds, and smells and dust generated by the operations there, and further articulated how those impacts will worsen if the landfill expansion goes forward. Moreover, petitioners allege that those impacts will impair the use and enjoyment of the public park, trails, and boat launches across the river. While one of the individual petitioners described how she was intimately involved in the development of a trail system and boat launch along the river and was similarly concerned by those impacts. Standing rules are not to be applied in a manner so restrictive that agency actions are insulated from judicial review, and in our view, the foregoing was sufficient to establish that at least some of the petitioners in each proceeding will suffer environmental impacts different from those experienced by the general public, so as to afford standing to sue." So the takeaway here, standing is often a stumbling block for residents who wish to contest a finding on the environmental impact of a project. Here it was the expansion of a landfill. To have standing, a petitioner must show the project has an impact on him or her which is greater than the impact on the general public. Here the residents who had an unobstructed view of the landfill, residents who personally experienced the sounds, smells, and dust generated by the landfill, and residents who used public parks, trails, and boat launches in the vicinity of the landfill were deemed to have standing. Next is Bank of New York Mellon on pages 26 and 27. It's a foreclosure action, and it involves a couple of issues that come up very often in foreclosure cases. Those issues being whether the notice requirements of Real Property Actions and Proceedings Law, that's RPAPL, section 1304, were met, and whether the bank was able to demonstrate that it had standing to bring the action. Most of the time, these issues come up because the evidence submitted in the summary judgment motion by the bank was deemed insufficient. The court wrote, "The plaintiff failed to submit an affidavit of mailing or proof of first-class mailing by the United States Postal Service, evidencing that it properly mailed notice to the defendant pursuant to Real Property Actions and Proceedings Law, Section 1304. Instead, the plaintiff relied on an affidavit of Sherry Benight, who was employed as a document control officer for Select Portfolio Servicing, which began servicing the subject loan on plaintiff's behalf in July of 2015, as well as copies of the purported notices dated July 2013. Although one of the notices contained a first-class mail 10-digit barcode, the plaintiff submitted no evidence that the letter was actually sent by first-class mail more than 90 days prior to the commencement of the action. In her affidavit, Benight stated that she could confirm that the notice was sent to the defendant on July 22, 2013. However, Benight did not have personal knowledge of the purported mailing. Further, since she did not aver that she was familiar with the mailing practices and procedures of Bank of America, the entity that purportedly sent the notices, she did not establish proof of a standard office practice and procedure designed to ensure that items are properly addressed and mailed. To the extent that Benight relied upon a screenshot of a track rights transaction report, she failed to establish how or when the report was created, that it was made in the regular course of business, or that it was created soon after the notices were purportedly mailed to the defendant. The plaintiff also attempted to establish standing through the submission of Benight's affidavit, but this also was insufficient. Benight asserted that the original note was delivered to the plaintiff on September 7, 2004, and that the plaintiff had since remained in possession of the note. Benight, however, did not have personal knowledge of the plaintiff's receipt of the note, did not attest that she had personal knowledge of the plaintiff's business practices and procedures, and also did not submit any admissible business records to show that the plaintiff possessed the note at the time the action was commenced. So the takeaway here, summary judgment in favor of the plaintiff bank in foreclosure actions is very often reversed because the affidavit submitted failed to prove compliance with the notice requirements of Real Property Actions and Proceedings Law, Section 1304, and the standing requirement, that being the possession of the note when the foreclosure action was brought. Here, the affiant lacked personal knowledge of the mailing of the notice, the possession of the note, and the relevant business practices. In addition, the affiant did not attach the necessary business records in admissible form. Where a bank moves for summary judgment in a foreclosure action, these and similar omissions are commonplace. Next is Chavez, on pages 27 and 28. It's out of the Court of Appeals. It deals with the tolling of the statute of limitations for class actions where several jurisdictions are involved, either federal and state or different states. The Court of Appeals, in a full opinion by Judge Stein over a three-judge partial dissent, answering certified questions from the Second Circuit, held 1. New York recognizes the tolling of the statute of limitations for absent members of the putative class actions filed in another state and in federal courts. It's called cross-jurisdictional tolling. And 2, the tolling of the statute ceases when the filed actions are terminated, even for reasons not on the merits, for example, forum non conveniens or a denial of certification for any reason. Here, class actions stemming from the use of a pesticide in the growing of bananas, involving foreign plaintiffs from countries where bananas are grown, were filed in Texas in 1993. The Texas actions were dismissed in 1995. The instant action was filed in 2012 in the Southern District of New York. The court wrote, "We hold that tolling ends as a matter of law when there is a clear dismissal of a putative class action, including a dismissal for forum non conveniens or denial of class certification for any reason. Under those circumstances, future plaintiffs are on notice that they must take steps to protect their rights because the litigation no longer compels the court to address class certification or the named plaintiffs to advance absent class members' interests. At that point, it is no longer objectively reasonable for absent class members to rely upon the existence of a putative class action to vindicate their rights, and tolling is extinguished. Thus, in this case, the 1995 Texas orders that dismissed that action on forum non conveniens grounds ended the tolling as a matter of law. Next is Batavia Townhouses, pages 28 and 29. It deals with the requirements to revive a statute of limitations in a foreclosure action. Fourth Department, in a full opinion by Justice Perdotto, held that General Obligations Law Section 17-105, not Section 17-101, applied to the revival of an expired statute of limitations for foreclosure of a mortgage, and the documents in this case did not meet the criteria of Section 17-105. Therefore, the foreclosure action was time-barred. The court wrote, "The financial statements submitted by defendant do not meet the requirements of Subdivision 1 of Section 17-105 of the General Obligations Law, because those documents merely list the mortgage as a liability and do not constitute an express promise to pay the mortgage debt." So the takeaway here, any document purporting to revive the statute of limitations for a foreclosure action must include an express promise to pay the mortgage debt. Next is U.S. Bank National Association, pages 29 and 30. It's a statute of limitations case, and it's another foreclosure action. The Third Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the foreclosure action was not time-barred. Although a foreclosure complaint was served in 2008, it named a deceased defendant and was therefore a nullity, which did not accelerate the debt and therefore did not start the statute of limitations running. The court wrote, "A party may not commence a legal action or proceeding against a dead person, but must instead name the personal representative of the decedent's estate." The mortgage company served but did not substitute the executor of decedent's estate as a party in the 2008 action, and it cites CPLR 1015 subdivision A. As such, the court lacked jurisdiction over the 2008 action, and that action was a legal nullity from its inception. Takeaway here, the six-year statute of limitations for a foreclosure is triggered when the action is commenced, but an action naming a deceased person as the defendant is a nullity, which does not trigger the statute of limitations. Next is Federal National Mortgage Association on pages 30 and 31. It's another foreclosure action and another statute of limitations issue. The Fourth Department, in a full opinion by Justice Curran, agreeing with the Second Department, held the mere presence of a reinstatement clause in a mortgage, which allows a borrower who has missed payments to pay the amount of the missed payments and resume monthly payments, does not affect or impede the acceleration of the debt when a foreclosure action is brought. Therefore, the foreclosure action at issue in this case was time-barred. The court wrote, "The mortgage is a uniform instrument issued by Fannie Mae, among others, for use in New York State and contains several provisions that are relevant on appeal. Section 22, the acceleration provision, permits the lender to require immediate payment of the loan in full upon the borrower's default, provided certain conditions are met. Section 19, the reinstatement provision, grants a borrower in default the right to effectively deaccelerate the maturity of the mortgage debt by paying in full the past due amount, thereby returning the loan to its pre-default status. We conclude that the mortgage's reinstatement provision does not in any way affect or impede acceleration of the full mortgage debt. The reinstatement provision is not mentioned anywhere in the text of the mortgage's acceleration provision, which governs when Fannie Mae could exercise its option to accelerate the full debt. Further, the language of the reinstatement provision indicates that Fannie Mae's right to accelerate the entire debt may be exercised before the borrower's rights under the reinstatement provision are exercised or extinguished. Thus, in effect, the reinstatement provision merely gives the borrower the contractual option to deaccelerate the mortgage when certain conditions are met, which presupposes that an acceleration has already occurred." So the takeaway here, once a foreclosure action is commenced, the debt is accelerated, meaning that the entire debt is due. The 6-year statute of limitations for obtaining a judgment of foreclosure starts when the debt is accelerated. A bank may explicitly notify the borrower that it is deaccelerating the debt, which stops the statute of limitations. But the mere presence of a clause in a mortgage which allows the borrower to stop the acceleration of the debt by paying what's owed and resuming monthly payments does not mean the debt was not accelerated when the foreclosure action was commenced and does not affect the running of the statute of limitations. Next is Wright versus Southampton Hospital. It's another statute of limitations case, this time dealing with a medical malpractice action and the continuous treatment doctrine. Second Department reversing Supreme Court held there were questions of fact about whether the continuous treatment applied such that the action was not barred by the statute of limitations. The court wrote, the plaintiffs raised a question of fact as to whether defendants' post-operative treatment of the patient, including rehabilitative therapy, wound care, and pain management, constituted a continuation of the course of treatment for the condition which originally gave rise to the alleged medical malpractice. And similarly, with respect to the cause of action against the rehabilitation center, the court wrote, the plaintiffs raised a question of fact as to whether the rehabilitation center's post-operative treatment of the patient, which included rehabilitative therapy, wound care, and pain management treatment through January 2015, constituted a continuation of the course of treatment for the condition which originally gave rise to the alleged medical malpractice. So the takeaway here, continuous treatment will extend the statute of limitations for medical malpractice to 2.5 years after the continuous treatment stops. In this case, the issue can't be resolved at the summary judgment stage and must be resolved by the jury. Next is Matter of Azalea K.L. It's on pages 32 and 33. It's a family court case, and it just is here because it demonstrates the difficulty of using a summary judgment action in the context of a neglect proceeding in family court. The Second Department reversing family court held that a derivative neglect finding stemming from a motion for summary judgment should not have been granted. Mother had participated in mental health treatment and had made progress since the prior neglect findings with respect to her older children. So here, because there were additional facts relating to the younger children, summary judgment should not have been based on rulings with respect to the older children. The court wrote, although there's no express provision for a summary judgment procedure in the Family Court Act Article 10, summary judgment pursuant to CPLR 3212 may be granted in such a proceeding when there's no triable issue of fact outstanding, and it cites Family Court Act Section 165 Subdivision A. In support of its motion, the Administration for Children's Services submitted the court's prior orders determining that the mother neglected the two older children. While there were findings of neglect as to the subject child's two siblings, there's no per se rule that a finding of neglect of one sibling requires a finding of derivative neglect with respect to the other siblings. The focus of the inquiry is whether the evidence of abuse or neglect of one child indicates a fundamental defect in the parent's understanding of the duties of parenthood. The Administration for Child Services failed to establish as a matter of law that under the circumstances, the neglect of the subject child's siblings merits a finding of derivative neglect as to the subject child. The medical records submitted by the Administration for Child Services demonstrated that the mother had failed to comply with her mental health treatment in late 2016, which noncompliance was a basis of the prior findings of neglect. However, the record submitted also demonstrated that the mother recommenced treatment in early 2017, immediately after the finding of neglect as to the second child, Akira, and that the mother was thereafter compliant and made positive progress in her mental health treatment for the following year. Accordingly, it cannot be said that the administrative Administration of Child Services established that the mother derivatively neglects the subject child through her failure to resolve the same issues that were the basis for the prior findings of neglect as to the older children. So the takeaway here, this is a rare use of summary judgment in a derivative neglect proceeding. Mother's response to mental health treatment raised a question of fact, whether she had neglected her younger child, making summary judgment unavailable in this context. Next is Harvard Steel Sales on page 33. The case deals with the venue of an action alleging fraud. The Fourth Department, in a full opinion by Justice Troutman, held New York County was the proper venue for this fraud action because plaintiff didn't demonstrate the fraudulent statements allegedly made by the defendant were made in Erie County as opposed to Cleveland, Ohio. Absent proof the statements were made in Erie County, the fact that defendant resides in New York County controlled. The court wrote, the legislature only recently added a provision to CPLR 503 subdivision A that allows venue based on the location of the events underlying the claim. But the federal rules of civil procedure contain an identical provision, that's 28 U.S.C. section 1391 subdivision B2, doubtless the model for the amended language in CPLR 503 subdivision A. In determining whether venue is proper under that provision, the Second Circuit applies a two-part inquiry. First, the court must identify the nature of the claims and the acts or omissions that the plaintiff alleges give rise to those claims. Second, the court must determine whether a substantial part of those acts or omissions occurred in the district where suit was filed, that is, whether significant events or omissions material to those claims have occurred in the district in question. In a fraud claim, the act giving rise to the claim is the alleged making of the fraudulent statement. Consistent with that, federal courts have found venue to be proper based upon where defendant allegedly made the fraudulent statements. Plaintiff failed to show that material fraudulent statements were made in Erie County. So the takeaway here, plaintiff didn't reside in Erie County where the fraud action was brought, and plaintiff couldn't demonstrate that the alleged fraudulent statements were made in Erie County. Therefore, the action must be brought in the county where the defendant resides, which is New York County. Next is Conio on page 34. It's a summary trial, and it deals with the issue of whether a motion to set aside the verdict can be brought when the stipulation for the summary trial does not allow such a motion. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held granting the motion to set aside the verdict in this personal injury trial violated the binding summary jury trial stipulation, which was entered into pursuant to the Richmond County summary trial jury trial rules. The court wrote, the plaintiff commenced this action to recover damages for personal injuries she allegedly sustained in an automobile accident. The parties subsequently entered into a stipulation to submit this matter to a binding summary jury trial pursuant to the Richmond County summary jury trial rules. In its verdict sheet, the jury found that defendant's negligence was not a substantial factor in causing the accident, but went on to assess her percentage of fault at 49%. The jury did not determine whether the plaintiff had sustained a serious injury and did not award any damages. Upon receiving the jury's verdict sheet, the Supreme Court informed the jury that there was no need to go on past the finding that defendant's negligence was not a substantial factor in causing the accident, and after ascertaining that all six jurors had signed the form, the trial court dismissed the jurors and announced that this constitutes a defense verdict. 4 days later, the plaintiff moved to set aside the verdict on the ground that it was internally inconsistent, and Supreme Court granted the motion. As the defendants contend, the Supreme Court exceeded the boundaries of the party's agreement by setting aside the verdict. So the takeaway here, the stipulation to submit the matter to a binding summary trial did not allow a motion to set aside the verdict. The stipulation controls and the defense verdict stands. At this point, I'm going to insert the verification code for this October 2020 Civil Procedure Update CLE. The verification code to be placed on your attorney affirmation is stipulation. Again, the verification code to be placed on your attorney affirmation for this October 2020 Civil Procedure Update CLE is stipulation. Next is Matter of 8th Judicial District Asbestos Litigation, which is on page 34. It deals with a motion to set aside the verdict in an asbestos case, toxic torts case, on the grounds that the evidence of causation was insufficient. Fourth Department held the evidence of causation in this asbestos exposure case was sufficient to support the plaintiff's verdict, and the motion to set aside was properly denied. The court wrote, although to prove specific causation, plaintiff and decedent were required to establish that the decedent was exposed to sufficient levels of the toxin to cause his alleged injuries, it is not always necessary for a plaintiff to quantify exposure levels precisely or use the dose-response relationship. There simply must be evidence from which the fact finder can conclude that the plaintiff was exposed to levels of the agent that are known to cause the kind of harm that the plaintiff claims to have suffered. Such evidence may include an expert's use of estimates generated by mathematical models, taking a plaintiff's work history into account, or the use of more qualitative means to determine the level of a plaintiff's exposure, such as comparing the plaintiff's exposure level to the exposure levels of subjects of other studies. So the takeaway here is the evidence of causation, that the injury was related to exposure to asbestos, although not precise, was sufficient, and therefore the motion to set aside the verdict was properly denied. And the final case is on pages 35 and 36, Paucay or Paucay, P-A-U-C-A-Y. It's a case dealing with a motion to set aside an inconsistent verdict. First Department, setting aside the verdict for future damages and ordering a new trial on that issue, held the awards for past pain and suffering and future medical expenses rendered the failure to award damages for future pain and suffering a material deviation from reasonable compensation. The court wrote, plaintiff failed to preserve for appellate review his claim that the verdict was inconsistent because the claim was raised after the jury had been discharged. However, where the jury verdict awards plaintiff damages for past pain and suffering and future medical expenses, but declines to award damages for future pain and suffering, the verdict on future pain and suffering is contrary to a fair interpretation of the evidence and constitutes a material deviation from what would be reasonable compensation. So the takeaway here, despite plaintiff's failure to raise a timely objection to the verdict as inconsistent because it was not made before the jury was discharged, the appellate court went ahead and set aside the verdict anyway. Because the jury awarded damages for past pain and suffering and future medical expenses, but failed to award damages for future pain and suffering, the appellate court held the verdict was a material deviation from reasonable compensation and ordered a new trial on future damages only. That concludes this October 2020 Civil Procedure Update CLE.